Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, on our weekly roundtable. The growing crisis in North Korea as China threatens that if the United States makes a preemptive strike against North Korea, they will have an obligation to defend North Korea. And the differences in response in the war on drugs and the opioid epidemic. Also, whatever happened to healthcare? Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, leader of the Senate, are feuding. Also, the latest on the presidential elections in Kenya. Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. More bellicose rhetoric on North Korea from President Donald Trump on Twitter this morning. Trump tweeting, quote, "Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. Should North Korea act unwisely, hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path." The tweet followed yesterday's statement from Trump from his New Jersey golf club aimed at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
"Let's see what he does with Guam. He does something in Guam, it will be an event the likes of which nobody's seen before, what will happen in North Korea."
There's also a new statement from North Korea which says, quote, "Trump is driving the situation on the Korean Peninsula to the brink of a nuclear war." Despite the rhetoric from Trump, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis yesterday indicated diplomacy is the preferred U.S. option.
"My portfolio, my mission, my responsibility is to have military options should they be needed. However, right now, Secretary Tillerson, Ambassador Haley, you can see the American effort is diplomatically led. It has diplomatic traction. It is gaining diplomatic results."
More than 60 House Democrats have signed a letter to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urging the utmost caution and restraint and expressing profound concern over the, quote, "irresponsible and dangerous statements" by Donald Trump on North Korea. The letter indicates support for Tillerson's recent statements calling for direct talks with the North. Michigan Congressman John Conyers said in a statement accompanying the letter, "He is ashamed that our commander-in-chief is conducting himself in a reckless manner that endangers our troops stationed in Korea and our regional allies," Conyers said. The U.S. and South Korea are about to launch new military exercises certain to ratchet up tensions. They'll involve tens of thousands of U.S. and South Korean troops on the ground and in the sea and air. North Korea regularly denounces the large-scale exercises. A new government report says global warming helped make 2016 the hottest year on record. The levels of greenhouse gases reached a new high. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration NOAA report highlighted numerous records, including hottest year, highest sea level, and lowest sea ice in the Arctic and Antarctica. Co-editor Jessica Blunden is a NOAA climate scientist.
"Overall, on average, the global growth rate of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has nearly quadrupled from 0.6 parts per million per year in the early 1960s to an average of about 2.3 parts per million per year over the past decade."
The 299-page report written by scientists around the world and published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society shows that 2016 was very extreme, and it is a cause for concern. The researchers called it a clear signal of human-caused climate change. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is proposing a meeting with President Trump. Maduro made the overture in a lengthy address to the 545 members of a new, all-powerful Constitutional Assembly.
"If you were so interested in Venezuela, Here I am. Here is the chief of your interests, Nicolas Maduro Moros, constitutional president of the Republic of Venezuela. Mr. Donald Trump, here is my hand. If it's about hands, here is my word.
The Trump administration has called Maduro a dictator and issued sanctions against him and more than two dozen other former and current officials. Donald Trump is suggesting that Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell might need to step aside if the Republicans don't begin passing his agenda.
I'm very disappointed in Mitch, but if he gets these bills passed, I'll be very happy with it, and I'll be the first to admit it. But honestly, repeal and replace of Obamacare should have taken place.
Trump has been denouncing McConnell's failure to pass an Obamacare repeal last month as a disgrace. Trump bristled this week after McConnell told an audience in his home state that Trump had not been in this line of work before and had excessive expectations about how quickly things happen in the democratic process. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is cracking down on social media and news websites with a vaguely worded decree that critics say will allow his government to jail anyone on charges of harming national unity or the social fabric. Social media and websites are the main outlets for debate and dissent in the West Bank. Activists say the edict issued without prior public debate is perhaps the most significant step yet by the Abbas government to restrict freedom of expression in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. It comes as the Israeli government is seeking to shut down Al Jazeera broadcasts and yank the credentials of Al Jazeera journalists in Israel. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is our weekly roundtable. And I'd like to welcome our panelists. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson. Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Laura, political analyst and writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration and gender issues in the America's Updater, Counterpunch, Fortune and others. She's a columnist for Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, and a commentator with CGTN, Democracy Now!, NPR, Al Jazeera, BBC, Mexican television and radio stations. She has participated as an analyst and activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border, and is host of the Mexican television program Huecho en America. Next, I'd like to welcome Jackie Goldberg. Jackie, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Jackie has served in the California State Assembly, previously as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. And before being on the City Council, she has also served on the Los Angeles School Board and as president of the school board. She's currently working on contract with the mayor's office on a program to hire more permanent city employees by 2018 to restore service that was cut or curtailed by previous layoffs. Jackie has been an educator all her life. And we'd like to welcome Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including most recently Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary. Okay, so we are going to kick off our roundtable today with our international session, starting, of course, with the growing crisis in North Korea. The Global Times, a state-owned newspaper in China, has said that China would intervene if the U.S. strikes North Korea first, if the U.S. strikes North Korea preemptively. But they would remain neutral if North Korea makes the first strike against the U.S. China has a long-standing treaty with North Korea, which says that China must intervene if North Korea is the subject of unprovoked aggression. The agreement is entitled the Sino-North Korean Treaty of Friendship. Analysts have long thought that China wants to maintain the status quo. In other words, not to have a unified Korea. While at the same time, China not wanting the threat of North Korea having nuclear weapons. They don't want any destabilization right at their borders. The Washington Post reports that hundreds of thousands of Chinese died during the 1950 to 1953 Korean War, and the context of the Korean War and its aftermath is crucial in understanding what is happening now with the conflict with North Korea. The Korean War ended with an armistice. A peace treaty was never, ever signed. So technically, the United States is still at war with North Korea. And furthermore, Congress never formally declared the Korean War, although Congress did approve funding for the war. And on the question of the use of nuclear weapons, Donald Trump is reported to have said he is for banning nuclear weapons by all parties. Well, at the July 2017 UN-mandated General Assembly meeting to negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons, the United States was notably absent and did not sign the treaty. All nine nuclear weapons nations and U.S. allies boycotted the UN meeting, including NATO members. The Netherlands was the only NATO attendee, and they also refused to sign. But nevertheless, the treaty was signed by 122 other nations. And what a lot of people do not know is that North Korea signed such agreement at the UN's first Committee for Disarmament that met last October. So North Korea has signed a treaty to ban all nuclear weapons of all nations. The United States has not, despite the rhetoric from Trump. So can Trump order a preemptive nuclear strike versus North Korea? Yes, according to the 1946 Atomic Energy Act. Furthermore, such an order by Trump cannot be overridden by Congress or by anybody else. Although Ted Lieu, Democrat of California, is saying he will propose legislation to require congressional approval before the president can basically push the nuclear button. Questions are being raised about the veracity of the U.S. intelligence confirmation that North Korea now has the capacity to load a miniaturized nuclear weapon onto a missile. The story was first reported in the Washington Post, and it was information that came from one U.S. intelligence agency. But nevertheless, it was picked up as gospel around the world. Whatever the truth of the matter is, threat of war, Trump hopes, will give him a boost to continue to firm up his base and turn attention away from his growing troubles on the home front. Meanwhile, there are reports that there is a plan being considered by the United States of preemptively striking some of North Korea's nuclear arsenals. Who knows where that will lead? And the U.S. has also sent a warship close to an island claimed by China in the South China Sea, and that just ramps up the tensions with China. And the United States is also preparing for major war games aimed at sending a strong message to North Korea. But what does North Korea, China, and the United States really want out of all of this? Before our panelists weigh in on what is happening in North Korea, let's go to a clip now. I think it's from the Washington Post.
China using a face-to-face meeting to urge North Korea to stop missile tests. The country's foreign minister sat down with his Korean counterpart on Sunday, just hours after fresh sanctions on Pyongyang were agreed by the United Nations Security Council. North Korea has been under UN sanctions since 2006 over its ballistic missile and nuclear programs. The new measures, voted through unanimously on Saturday, were a response to five nuclear tests and four long-range missile launches. China has expressed support for the decision, but stressed sanctions are not the sole solution, and dialogue is vital to resolve a complex and sensitive issue, now at a, quote, critical juncture. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Li told reporters he had urged the North Koreans to calmly handle the resolutions and, quote, not do anything unbeneficial towards the international community, such as missiles or nuclear tests. Wang declined to say what response he received. He went on to encourage the United States and South Korea not to increase the tension. The U.S. has long maintained that China has not done enough to rein in North Korea. with the countries negotiating for a month on the new resolution. The North Korea standoff is expected to dominate Monday's ASEAN Regional Forum, where 27 foreign ministers, including those of Russia, the United States, China, and North and South Korea, have gathered in the Philippines to discuss security issues.
All righty, and that meeting has actually already taken place. But Laura Carlson, let's start with you here because, you know, Trump is ramping up. He's not backing down. They're all practically everybody's likely heard reports of him talking about fire and fury and raining down on North Korea, and General Mattis talking about the destruction of the people of North Korea. And yesterday, Trump, rather than ramping down his rhetoric, stepped it up and said it likely wasn't tough enough. Meanwhile, it's causing worry and concern actually across the world as people are looking to see what's going to happen next. And there are two schools of thought. One is that not that much is really going to happen. I mean, that there's going to be a lot of rhetoric, but there are going to be no nuclear weapons dropped. And another is that we really don't know what Trump is going to do. And then you heard the Chinese who said that if Trump makes the first move, that they have an obligation by treaty to defend North Korea. But they're also warning North Korea that if they make the first move, China will remain neutral. And China is playing a critical role in all of this. So your thoughts on what's going on? Is this a dangerous play to Trump's base? What world are we living in now? Laura Carlson, your thoughts on all of this?
I think it's a frightening situation, Margaret, and especially because we really do not know. We look at these statements and now talking about military solutions being locked and loaded. So there's a game of brinkmanship going on that's not, as you mentioned, even just international. He's sending messages once again to his base at the risk of nothing short of nuclear war on an international level. So there could be nothing more dangerous than this situation. Now, whether it comes to nothing or whether something terrible happens, of course we don't know. And of course we have to hope, you know, that it doesn't go this far and that it is just not exactly a bluff, but some bluster on the part of Donald Trump, which we've become used to. In any case, it represents a grave misreading, if there were a strategic point to it, of North Korea, because, of course, as Trump escalates, North Korea rhetoric, at least, escalates as well. There are basically four options, according to the Washington Post: doing nothing, using sanctions, pushing for talks, or going to military confrontation. And on the part of experts, there's no question whatsoever but that a military confrontation would be an absolute disaster. The only possible outcome of any type of military confrontation is destruction in a real lose-lose scenario. It would be almost inevitable, most think, that South Korea would be hit. And we've got to remember, too, that in South Korea and Japan, there are more than 70,000 U.S. troops put together. And then, of course, we have the nuclear factor as well, with unpredictable results. And this is ironic, too, in the sense that the diplomacy path had been advancing. We had the U.N. sanctions, it's unanimous, and there was talk on the part of the Trump administration itself, both from Mattis and from Tillerson, that there have been advances along this course. So once again, we're seeing Trump as the rogue president breaking off from his own cabinet to make these inflammatory declarations in an extremely delicate situation and at a time where other paths are open, so that the only possible advantage you could see in making these kinds of declarations is to get a bunch of people whipped up to say, yep, that's our macho president. He's gonna take control here and kicked our asses, basically.
Right. And Laura Carlson, just very briefly, last roundtable, we talked a little bit about Venezuela. There's just a little bit more news now that Mercosur, which is a kind of a trade bloc in Latin America, they have suspended Venezuela. But meanwhile, also the British opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, he has declined to condemn Maduro, and he took a position of principle. He was under a lot of pressure to condemn Maduro. And Argentina's soccer legend Maradona has said he is a soldier for Venezuela's Maduro. And several Republican congressmen and the oil industry in the United States is writing to Trump and saying, you better not slap any oil sanctions on Venezuela, because basically we need the crude. Just quick thoughts, any quick updates in terms of what you're hearing in relation to Venezuela?
Well, to that extremely complicated list of recent events, you can also add the fact of the failed attack on a military base that looked like kind of a pre-coup thing, which Maduro is blaming the United States of having supported, and with the history of it, it could be true, it could not be true, we don't really know.
Right.
But that increased the tensions, and then Maduro just recently said, okay, well, let's sit down together, and offered to have a face-to-face discussion with Donald Trump, which he most likely will refuse. But so there's no gain in completely isolating Venezuela now. And it's true that the United States cannot cut off the oil sanctions. That's why the sanctions so far that we've seen have to do with individuals and their particular assets in the United States, rather than being anything much broader. So there's an interdependent relationship there that would dictate that some kind of negotiations and pushing Venezuela into a mediation process would be the best path. And yet, again, out of Washington, we're not seeing clear strategies. We're not seeing rational thinking in terms of international problem solving. And both these cases are examples of that.
Yeah, Leopoldo Lopez, he's now back under house arrest. A lot was being made that he was removed from house arrest and placed back in prison, but apparently now he's back in his home on house arrest. Now, Jackie Goldberg, to you on North Korea, there are reports that the Pentagon has prepared a plan, a contingency plan, to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea, which may involve U.S. Fighters, bombers, heavy bombs, we're told, from Guam. Your thoughts on all of this? And the question really is what do the major players, which at this point, the United States, North Korea, and China, really want out of all of this? And it seems to me as though at least China and South Korea, and Russia, by the way, want to maintain the status quo. North Korea, South Korea, and North Korea, it seems, wants to be left alone. They want to develop their nuclear program because they have learned the lesson that nations who give up their nuclear weapons become vulnerable, extremely vulnerable to the United States pressure, invasion, destabilization, etc., as happened in Libya. And they're saying, well, we're ready to sign no nuclear weapons if everybody else gives up their nuclear weapons. But your thoughts on all of this, do you really think that we are at a dangerous stage, or is it really just a lot of talk and bluster and, you know, machismo going on here?
Well, I think it's mostly the latter. I think this is Trump. You know, nobody's talking about the Russian investigation right now, right? It's off the press. I just looked through two newspapers. I didn't see a word about it in either one of them. So that's already a victory for him.
Yeah.
That's what Trump wants to do. He wants to seize the initiative, to look bold, to look strong, to look like he kept calling the former administration's wimps about Korea and so forth and so on. I think there is some small sector of rational people who believe that bold talk to North Korea is what North Korea understands and that it will lead to negotiations. The problem is, of course, there's always a very humongous danger of misinterpretation of the meaning of words, particularly when you translate between Korean and English, and I don't mean that lightly, and that miscommunication could lead very seriously to a catastrophic effect. I don't think it would be nuclear. I think it would be conventional arms, but it wouldn't matter. It would cause enormous, enormous loss of life and destruction. And I think what's really happening is that the diplomatic efforts need to increase. I think a couple of interesting questions always come to mind. And one is that the last test of a missile was a couple of weeks ago. So why this rhetoric now? Why this war of words now by Trump? Another big question is, why can't Tillerson and Trump be on the same page publicly? And that's a really big question, because in international relations, when there's a mixed signals from an administration, whether it's the United States or anywhere else, it means that your opponent really seriously is not sure what your policy is. And that's the most dangerous part of all of this, because there is no assurance to North Korea that Trump isn't interested in a first strike. And that is what's scaring them. On the other hand, we have had ample evidence that North Korea makes these bullying sands all the time and takes no action. I think really the key question is whether or not the United States is willing to remove preconditions to talks. I think that's the big problem. The United States has said that Korea has to give up, North Korea has to give up its nuclear testing in order to have any talks. And North Korea says, in order to have any talks, so we have to give up our joint military plans with South Korea, which are due this month. I think if the United States were to scale back its joint military, you would see a change in all of this, but it's not clear that Trump is willing to do that. Remember that we referred to his military person as Mad Dog. That's a very scary part of all of this, too, because the notion is we don't strike first, but if we strike second, we wipe everybody out. That's a pretty frightening thought for North Korea. So it's a very complicated situation, but the dangers are enormous, because the dangers are that people misunderstand the rhetoric for reality, and somebody on one side or another does something that the other assumes is a first strike, and then we have catastrophe.
The thing is, Jackie, on your point that it may really just be a war of words than anything else, is that some people are raising, and the thought had occurred to me when all of this broke, because it came out as in a report in the Washington Post that was verified by one U.S. intelligence agency, that North Korea now has that kind of nuclear capability, right? The miniaturized warhead, et cetera, on the missile. But one has to wonder if Trump has at the back of his head that maybe North Korea doesn't have this capacity. What does he know that we don't know? And therefore, he could run his mouth the way he has been running it, right? And more or less calling North Korea's bluff. But this move about saying, well, we will go even if using conventional weapons and bomb any parts of North Korea, that's also dangerous, because it also sends a dangerous signal to China that is a nuclear power, right?
Right. Well, the whole thing is fraught with danger, because, first of all, there is no way yet that North Korea can deliver nuclear weapons to the United States, even with its better missiles. And even with its miniaturizing the warheads, it has no reentry vehicle. It has no way to withstand the pressure of going up into outer space and coming back into Earth's atmosphere without disintegrating. And everyone knows that. But it doesn't mean that it's far away. They may get it this year. They may get it next year. They're certainly going to pursue it until they get it. So that part is true. The problem is that there are many countries with nuclear weapons that aren't using them. We have India and Pakistan, both having nuclear weapons that aren't using them. So the question isn't really whether you get them or not. The question is, what is the United States policy going to be toward nonproliferation? And can it get the world to get back on schedule to talking about nonproliferation and to talk about eventual disarmament? That's not going to happen so far. I mean, what Trump says is that he's ordered a modernization of our nuclear powers. Well, actually, that happened in 2010 under Obama, not under him. So he's lying about that again. He didn't do anything. Obama did that, and Obama did that in order to get the continuation of the START treaty through a Republican Congress. So there's all this stuff that they're just lying about, but this is mostly about Trump to his base and Trump to getting some news about something besides Russia on the events. But it's a dangerous game because misunderstandings have led to war before. And a conventional war could be just as catastrophic or almost as catastrophic as nuclear war. I don't think there will be a nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula now, but it doesn't mean I don't think that there could be a conventional war or a conventional attack on both sides that could leave lots and lots of people dead.
Right. And Dr. Gerald Horn, your thoughts on all this in terms of the crisis in North Korea. And after that comment, Dr. Horn, I'm hoping that you'll be able to comment on a story we covered earlier this week, presidential elections happening in several African countries, the most recent being in Kenya, where there's a lot of controversy. And John Kerry was actually on the ground in Kenya. And one has to wonder what all that's about. And the United States saying that no Kenyan should die because of the vote. But it's very, very contentious what's going on there. But let us start with your thoughts now on where things are with this crisis in North Korea and the United States.
Well, like you, I would point to the Washington Post story that helped to presumably kick off this latest crisis. Interestingly enough, their source was the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, not the CIA, mm-hmm. nor any of the other 17 U.S. intelligence agencies. Interestingly enough, it has also been reported that this same story about miniaturization of a warhead was reported 4 or 4.5 years ago. And yet, somehow it has reappeared and seems like news. It's all very curious. Second of all, I would point to the story that you highlighted in your introduction in the Global Times of China, which speaks for the more militant sectors in Beijing, which was a shot across the bow to Washington, at least according to Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, who is a favorite interlocutor in Washington since he speaks fluent Putonghua, the main language in China. And as he interpreted this was a signal to Washington that China would not sit on its hands if Washington engages in unilateral military action. And recall that during the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, which you also mentioned, the turning point was when the Chinese military crossed the border with North Korea, hundreds of thousands, and pushed back the Yankee forces almost into the sea. And it seems like we're having a replay of that scenario. Now, he outlined a grand bargain between the parties and amongst the parties, that is to say, North Korea perhaps limiting or even relinquishing its nuclear weapons in return for a peace treaty, diplomatic recognition by Washington, involving a security guarantee from both China, perhaps even and Russia, and a staged withdrawal of U.S. troops who are in South Korea in the tens of thousands from the Korean Peninsula. Now, right now, it does not seem as if Washington wants to go there, but ultimately it may be forced by events to do so. Now, with regard to these African elections that you mentioned, all of these elections, be they in Rwanda, Kenya, or in Angola later this month, basically reflect the dilemmas of the legacy of colonialism. That is to say that in Kenya, British colonialism started in the 1890s with the settler project. Interestingly enough, some of the leading settlers were Euro-Americans, so-called white Americans, and they still dominate the commanding heights of the Kenyan economy, forcing the indigenous population to scramble to control the government so that they can be the beneficiaries of contracts. With regard to Angola, you may recall that after independence in 1975, vouchsafed, of course, by the presence of troops from Cuba, Angola tried to build socialism, but the United States basically said you cannot build socialism, you cannot share the wealth. And so now Angola has been removed from the world headlines, but of course it has this gaping maldistribution of wealth featuring the daughter of the president, who reportedly has a bigger fortune than Oprah Winfrey. And of course, we should not be indifferent to these particular events, as evidenced by the fact that the leading prison in Louisiana is called Angola State Prison, and the leading center in New Orleans is Congo Square, the northern neighbor of Angola, representing the fact that a significant percentage of the Black American population is of Angolan descent and hails from that region. Now, the elections in Rwanda that just took place last week also reflects that legacy because, of course, you know that in 1994 there was this major genocide, a genocide not least sparked by the fact that Belgian colonialists had tried to drive a wedge between the two major ethnic groups, the Hutu and the Tutsis, and that legacy still haunts Rwanda. The leader, Paul Kagame, was trained in the United States, has been accused justifiably of persecuting his political opponents. But once again, until we grapple with this legacy of colonialism and the ongoing imperialist project, we'll be forced into these cliches about African elections and about so-called tribal conflict that somehow supposedly does not have a cure.
Right. Well, thank you for that, Dr. Horn. We're going to be doing some follow-up on these elections and what is happening on the continent. And, of course, Kabila in the Congo seems to be, Democratic Republic of Congo, to be refusing to hold elections entirely. And we all know that there's been a genocide basically going on in the Congo. A lot of corruption among the government there, as well as several other governments on the continent. And we know very well that U.S. intelligence has said that one of the strategies they use is corruption to put forward their influence. We're going to take a station break now, and when we return, we'll go to what's happening on the domestic front, healthcare, the opioid epidemic, and more. Stay with us. Our roundtable will be right back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this roundtable, you can subscribe for a free podcast. You can listen to the show anytime in the city, nation, or indeed the world if you do that. And we're also available on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the country of Kenya. We'll give them a shout out today. You can also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. Also, all of our past shows are archived there. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And it is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. Now, a lot of news related, healthcare related news. There is healthcare, the healthcare bill, or Trump Care, and its demise and what may be coming up next. And then there's also the so-named opioid epidemic and Trump declaring it a crisis and contrasting how this opioid epidemic that is hitting hard in white suburbs and white communities and the contrast with how that is being addressed as opposed to the drug epidemic like the crack epidemic that hit inner cities and Black communities in South LA and others so hard that caused the rise in mass incarceration. Now, the GOP Republicans, they've been angling to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act for the past 7 years, ever since President Obama signed it into law in 2010. And Republicans took the first stab at creating the new health care bill with the so-named American Health Care Act, which very narrowly passed in May. Then a small group of Republican senators, that was in the House, and the senators, all male, all white, worked on a revised version of the bill behind closed doors. What they came out with was the dig this name, Better Care Reconciliation Act, which drew as much criticism as the House's version. Now, although the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, was successful in getting a discussion on health care, a 50-50 vote that Mike Pence had to be the tiebreaker of, getting a majority vote to approve any version of the bill was unsuccessful. The final attempt was a so-called skinny repeal of Obamacare, stripping away many of the provisions and of Obamacare and called the Health Care Freedom Act. These names could get very confusing. But even that failed. And in a very dramatic fashion, a 51-49 vote, John McCain joined two women, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, Maine's Susan Collins, and of course, they're both Republicans, and all of the Democrats in the Senate to basically kill the bill. And since the skinny bill failed July 27th, Trump and McConnell have been pointing fingers, blaming each other for the failure. Let's go now to a clip on all of this. The first, we're going to start with Trump pressuring McConnell to pass the bill. And Trump is now trashing the Senate leader McConnell. A lot of people are wondering, what is he thinking? Let's go to that clip now.
A sitting president openly feuding with the Senate majority leader of his own party is rare, very rare. But tonight, President Trump is escalating his criticism of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, going so far as to envision the Kentucky Republican stepping down if he can't get key legislation across the finish line. All of this ahead of what promises to be a very busy legislative calendar this fall. Chief Washington correspondent James Rosen has the story.
Responding to reporters' questions at his golf club in New Jersey, President Trump suggested that if the White House legislative agenda remains stalled, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell should step down from his leadership post.
If he doesn't get repeal and replace done, and if he doesn't get taxes done, meaning cuts and reform, and if he doesn't get a very easy one to get done, infrastructure, if he doesn't get them done, then you can ask me that question.
Those comments followed what sources described as a tense phone call between the two men Wednesday morning, in which Mr. Trump was said to have conveyed his anger over criticism McConnell had publicly aired about the president.
They said, Mitch, get to work and let's get it done. They should have had this last one done. They lost by one vote. For a thing like that to happen is a disgrace. And frankly, it shouldn't have happened.
The comments that irked the president came from the leader's lips on Monday.
Our new president had, of course, not been in this line of work before, and I think had excessive expectations about how quickly things happen in the democratic process.
The president's on-camera remarks followed a pair of tweets tweaking McConnell, including one at 6:54 a.m. that asked, "Can you believe that Mitch McConnell, who has screamed repeal and replace for 7 years, couldn't get it done?" Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Trump supporter, appeared this morning on Fox and Friends, the president's favorite program, to say the president must own his share of the blame for the collapse of the Obamacare repeal.
He's part of the leadership team. He's not an observer sitting up in the stands. He's on the field. It was a collective failure.
There you go. And before we have our panelists weigh in, the opioid crisis, because that's also related to health care, because part of what Republican senators were doing to try to save Trump care, basically, was to pour in a lot of money for this so-named opioid epidemic. So what is at stake here? Over 2 million people in the United States are said to have a problem with opioids. Over 97 million people took prescription painkillers in 2015, 12 million of which did so without being directed by a doctor. You have the use of synthetic drugs like methadone and fentanyl grouped together in a category of substances called opioids. But it's not only these so-called synthetic drugs, some of which you can get by prescription, but also you find heroin and cocaine, et cetera, very much on the rise. And the highest overdose rates are clustered in places like Appalachia, the Rust Belt, New England, Maine. Trump called New Hampshire a drug den, which is why he said they voted for him, which in fact they didn't vote for him. So let us go now to a very short clip of Trump declaring the opioid crisis as a national emergency.
The opioid crisis is an emergency, and I'm saying officially right now it is an emergency. It's a national emergency. We're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money on the opioid crisis.
But you need emergency powers for
government. We're going to draw it up, and we're going to make it a national emergency. It is a serious problem, the likes of which we have never had. You know, when I was growing up, they had the LSD, and they had certain generations of drugs. There's never been anything like what's happened to this country over the last 4 or 5 years. And I have to say this, in all fairness, this is a worldwide problem, not just a United States problem. This is happening worldwide. But this is a national emergency, and we are drawing documents now to so attest.
Okay, so Laura Carlson, a national emergency. What a contrast in a way with the whole war on drugs, you know, in terms of tactics that are used by the United States. So your thoughts on this, and also any thoughts you have on health care. I mean, Bernie is also putting forward like single payer, and who knows what's going to happen, if anything. I just read this morning, I don't have the figures in front of me, but a national poll released on August 3rd found the majority of voters support replacing the current health care system with a single payer system in which Medicare covers every American. Laura Carlson, your thoughts on both of those?
On the healthcare system, I think that there are two things. First of all, this language and the spat between McConnell and Trump. What Trump is doing is he's constantly making himself out so that if there's a failure, which there have been consistently in almost all of his major legislative initiatives, he's not responsible. He's the victim. It's never his fault, and that's important to him. In fact, when the end comes, if the end comes before the end of his term, you know, he'll have this scenario ready to say, I was the victim. And the other part of it is that I think it's very positive that in this opportunity with the failure of the repeal, and the repeal, it's important to note, has never been about health care. It's always been about dismantling the Obama legacy. So this debate has been kind of off track from the very beginning in many ways. But with these no proposals that are coming in, the single payer, especially from Bernie Sanders, we're beginning to see people talking about what does the United States want for a health care system. And we see this very pronounced trend with more than half of Democrats saying that they are ready for single payment and for single payer and for Medicare for all, which is what Bernie Sanders is proposing. He's doing it in a way that asks for input from the population. He says it's going to require a political revolution in which American people participate. So that's a healthy alternative, and not just for a healthcare system in crisis, but also for democracy. On the war on drugs, we may see with this national emergency declaration a trend in the very opposite direction. The language reminds us of drugs being public enemy number one under Nixon, and takes us back to the origins of the war on drugs model, which is a weak presidency. When a president is weak, he goes to this war on drugs to declare an external enemy and to begin to, again, ramp up incarceration of internal opposition. So there's a huge danger there. He's talking about spending more time, more money. Of course, you could theoretically spend more money on programs that would actually help in terms of treatment and rehabilitation, but all the signs we have so far are that it will not. He's placed this emphasis on how supposedly Obama did not address the problem because prosecutions fell. And in fact, again, the data is not being presented truthfully. In fact, there was a rise in prosecution, but more importantly is he's gotten through this, the press, to fall for the line that prosecutions are the correct way of measuring how to deal successfully with problematic drug use. And we know that that is absolutely wrong, and again, yeah, is a threat to democracy. And it also keeps out of the equation the pharmaceuticals. If you want a supply-side approach, then why not go out after pharmaceuticals, who are responsible for nearly half the deaths? Instead, the DEA has backed off, yeah, of enforcement, And so they go off scot-free. And again, finally, just they had, there's a split because Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, just came out saying that an emergency, national emergency wasn't necessary. So we've got chaos again in the White House.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. By the way, breaking news just coming through on AP that says a senior U.S. diplomat has engaged in back-channel diplomacy with North Korea for several months and that contacts are ongoing. Well, there's no surprise there. But Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts then on healthcare and also the opioid epidemic and the in contrast with the war on drugs.
Well, of course, the war on drugs are a big part of the problem. I mean, you know, when you make something illegal, you can't address the health care needs of people who are addicted because for them to come forward puts them at risk of incarceration. So I think that the one thing I want to say, maybe not entirely on our topic, is that Jeff Sessions may be the single most dangerous person in America today. I mean, he's trying to undo civil rights enforcement. He's trying to undo the ability of people to be allowed to vote by releasing states from having to worry about being sued if they set up blocks to voting. He's trying to increase the penalties for all federal crimes, but especially drug crimes. And he's doing an enormous amount of harm that's largely being uncovered because we're talking about other things and people are talking about protecting Sessions in order to keep Mueller in place.
Oh,
and I think we need to have a whole session sometime on just Jeff Sessions. I'm just going to
suggest agree.
But in the meantime, what we really have here is a public health crisis that has been going on for many, 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 many years. The difference between the approach here and the approach when it was South Central L.A. getting Oliver North's drugs dumped in there to fund the war against socialism in Central America. What we have here is a situation in which there is both danger and opportunity, which often come together. And the opportunity is that increasingly Americans are saying, you know what, why don't we just expand Medicare? It works, you know, I have seniors in my family. They're doing pretty well on Medicare. Why can't I get it? And I think you're going to see that with Bernie Sanders, that he's not going to get his bill passed. There's no chance in the world. But he is going to get more people, more Democrats to sign on to it. He is going to push the Democratic Party to move away from saying that, well, only thing that needs to be done is to fix Obamacare, which it does need to be fixed, because now what's happening is that there are state exchanges telling health care providers to up their
premiums are definitely going up. Yeah,
they're not going to get reimbursed by the federal government, which is Obama, which is Trump's promise is not to do this. And I think it's more than just getting rid of Obamacare to get rid of Obama's legacy. It's also to provide massive tax breaks for the rich. That's the chief motivating factor, although he will say it's to get rid of, personally, I think Trump wants to get rid of Obama's legacies. Yes, that's true. But I think the chief motivating factor in Congress is to give a big tax break to all the millionaires and billionaires in the country.
I do want to give Dr. Horn a chance to weigh in here. We just have about a minute and a half left. Dr. Horn, sorry you're a little shortchanged here. But Dr. Horn, when you in talking about this whole opioid epidemic, nobody's really talking about why people end up addicted. And Gabor Mate has part of his analysis is that basically the kind of alienation that people feel from the market and this out of control capitalism is really a feeding ground for addiction of all kinds, drugs, food, you know, alcohol, whatever people in the United States could basically get their hands on. Dr. Horn, just some quick final thoughts from you.
There's another factor as well, which is that Black people are not as impacted by this opioid abuse epidemic, so-called.
Yeah.
Studies suggest that medics are oftentimes oblivious to our pain, and they don't give us painkillers. It's interesting to note as well that a number of states are now suing the manufacturers of these drugs, these modern-day drug pushers, and that, of course, would include the fabulously wealthy Sackler family whose names are in a number of leading museums across the United States of America. Now, I'd caution all of us to take those polls about U.S. people in support of single payer with a shaker of salt, because we know that as soon they're thinking of single payer for people like themselves. But if you tell them that single black mothers might get single payers, then, of course, they'll object.
Yeah.
And so that ties into another factor, which is that many of our social democratic friends used to tell us that race-based remedies should be ditched in favor of class-based remedies like health care, which would be uniting of the working class. We see how that worked out with the attack on Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act.
Right. On that note, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Gerald Horn, Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, another fascinating roundtable. Thank you. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, Sherelle Withers, our intern assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our engineer, Kiana Williams. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to Pacifica Radio Archives. .org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.